KBOO is proud to partner with Hopworks Urban Brewery for their Community Tap program. Every month, Hopworks features a local nonprofit organization, and May's Community Tap is your community radio, KBOO. Hopworks is located at 2944 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. For more information on Hopworks and their Community Tap program, you can go to kboo.fm/hub.
How I'd love to wander back.
Hi there. This is Rheta Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this May 18th Monday. Patsy Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, we open with Old Mole Bill Resnick interviewing Brian Tokar about Bernie Sanders and his recently announced bid to become a 2016 presidential candidate. Brian Tokar directs the Institute for Social Ecology in Burlington, Vermont, teaches at University of Vermont, and has written several books. Then it's The Left and the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, featuring a discussion about the role of video cameras in anti-police activism, documenting police abuse, and the movement to have officers wear video cameras on duty. Does it matter who's holding the camera? In the second half of our show this morning, well-read Red Tom Becker reads the article Warrior Capitalism, Middle Class, What Middle Class? Written by Jack A. Smith. It's about the disappearance of class terms, i.e. ruling class, upper class, working class, in political discussions by both politicians and journalists. The author contends the lone remaining class term, the middle class, is also on its way out. And we conclude our show this morning with Politics and Psychology. Jan Hocken and Todd Sloan discuss what psychoanalytic psychology can tell us about public responses to climate change and environmental activism, and how to imagine that another world is possible. This is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning. And thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO in programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour, 20 years and counting. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now we turn to Bill Resnick and Brian Tokar.
Hi, Brian Tokar. Welcome to KBOO.
Bill, great to be with you.
Both Brian Tokar and Bernie Sanders, who's the subject of today's interview, the senator from Vermont who just announced his candidacy for the U.S. president and is going to run in the Democratic Party primaries against Hillary Clinton, both Brian and Bernie started their life work both in politics in the same small city, Burlington, Vermont. Brian Tokar started as a student, a radical, at the Institute for Social Ecology. He now directs the Institute, also teaches at the University of Vermont. He's also an activist in the Green Party, and he writes books, including The Green Alternative. And your latest book, Brian, is?
Toward Climate Justice.
So, Brian Tokar, you and the other B of Burlington, Bernie Sanders, you've grown up together.
In 1980, Bernie was known in Burlington as kind of a perennial third-party candidate for mostly statewide office and definitely a fixture in the radical scene in Vermont, which was quite active then and continues to be quite active now. Bernie really surprised everybody by announcing his candidacy for mayor of Burlington in 1981, a race which he won by a very narrow margin. I think it was 10 or 15 votes. and then went on to serve several terms as mayor of Burlington, and then after a few years started running for Congress and got elected to Congress and eventually to the Senate, where he's served now for, I think, at least three terms.
He's certainly at least two terms. He was always an independent, though, in Congress. Is that right? Called himself a socialist. He blocked, though, with the Democratic Party and their left wing. And then last week he announced he's going to challenge Hillary Clinton. He was always, of course, critical of the Clinton White House and the Clinton administration and Clinton policies. Now he's challenging Hillary. Let's talk about those early years. In the early years when Bernie was in the 80s, when Bernie was mayor of Burlington, I know the Institute for Social Ecology was extremely critical of him, and Bernie actually fought back, apparently. What were the issues that divided the Institute from Bernie?
The big issue in the 80s during Bernie's terms as mayor for a lot of us was his relationship with the real estate development community in Burlington. He was consistently supported by one of the big real estate developers in his various campaigns. And as kind of a return for that, he supported a whole series of proposals for what a lot of us viewed as really disproportionate commercial development of Burlington's waterfront. This was, at the time, a semi-abandoned industrial waterfront, and real estate interests in Vermont really saw it as a place where they could make a lot of money very quickly. Since then, we've seen development on the waterfront at a much more modest pace, but what Bernie supported were a series of mega projects that were vehemently opposed by a lot of neighborhood activists, a lot of environmentalists, and those of us at the Institute for Social Ecology and studying with Murray Bookchin at the time were very much part of the opposition to those real estate schemes. There was also a proposal for a big trash incinerator. They built a big wood chip burning power plant, which is partly responsible for Burlington, which has a municipal utility, actually being one of the first cities in the country to be able to say that its energy source, its electricity sources, are 100% renewable. But of course, it's also one of the biggest sources of air pollution in Vermont. Trash incinerator, Bernie eventually came around and dropped that proposal, partly for financial reasons and partly because we were able to make a very strong case that it would be a really extreme pollution problem for Burlington if they were to build a big incinerator.
I guess part of Bernie's success and popularity was that he, in some ways, rebuilt Burlington. That is, brought in a lot of real estate interests, did a lot more housing, sold a lot of houses to New Hampshire people and Boston people, apparently.
And New York people. There was a huge gentrification of downtown Burlington during Bernie's time as mayor. Partly it was a result of development of a pedestrian mall, which was really a plus to get traffic off one of the major commercial streets. But on the other hand, that street went from being populated almost entirely by local businesses that serve local needs to being, like you see in many other cities, a street full of high-end shops aimed at tourists, a lot of chain stores, and that sort of thing.
Well, yes, and I suppose the river section became a kind of a tourist mall and
yes.
outlet
Well, it
stores
didn't become a mall. Bernie's proposal included the idea of a big mall right on the Lake Champlain waterfront. Mm-hmm. That was one of the projects that was defeated, but there are luxury condos overlooking Lake Champlain, which has an incredible view of the Adirondack Mountains in New York State across 10 miles on the other side. There's a big hotel that was already there that has expanded. There are other major hotels and commercial projects and big condo projects that have come in pretty gradually over the course of now the last 30, 35 years, which has taken its toll on Burlington, but it's, I think in a lot of ways, still not as severe a blow to the livability of the city for modest income people as the mega project that Bernie and some of his allies in the real estate crowd were pushing back then.
And many of them then were defeated, apparently.
Yeah.
Ah, well, congratulations. Bernie managed to rise with the flow, though, right? He sort of accepted some of these defeats and just kept going onward. He became so popular in Vermont. Why is that? What do you make of it?
Well, he's done a terrific job of appealing to a strong populist instinct that exists here. And he's managed to do it in a way that really does cut across some political lines. He lost his first race for Congress against Republican, I recall, and then 2 years later came back and defeated that incumbent Republican congressman, who's kind of an obscure figure whose name I don't even remember, and has since then won every statewide race except for one race for governor by an overwhelming margin, really appealing to people across political lines. He has tremendous support among the elderly population. He has tremendous support from veterans groups, as well as more traditionally progressive tendencies in Vermont politics. I think part of the deal he's made to sustain the support of the veterans groups here is that he's, except in really extreme cases like the Iraq War, where he was clearly in the forefront of the congressional opposition, he tends to be very supportive of the military budget, of various initiatives of the U.S. military. There was a big fight when he was in Congress during the 1990s, when Bill Clinton was bombing Serbia. And Bernie was a staunch defender of that military involvement in Europe and got in some really public, almost brawls with people around the state who were really quite furious with him for supporting Bill Clinton's military escapades in the Balkans.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to Brian Tokar. He and Bernie Sanders were doing politics in Burlington, Vermont for many, many years. Brian with left groups, Bernie as an independent, calling himself a socialist, basically running as and satisfying people as a militant social democrat. That is, he served the needs of his constituency, and his constituents included the developers, but he served the veterans by being in favor of veterans' health care and lots of benefits to veterans for old people. Being one of the staunch defenders of Social Security. He was not a radical Democrat. That is, he fought for the development of city institutions that were democratically run. He was at sort of a top-down, good, progressive New Deal type of manager.
I think that's a fair assessment. And over the years, there's been some tension between Bernie's tendency to run as an independent and the evolving progressive party here in Vermont, even. Bernie, of course, played an important role in the early 80s by getting elected mayor and having a successful administration in Burlington in helping build the progressive party. But as soon as he started running for statewide office, for Congress and Senate, and at least once for governor, he really distanced himself from the Progressive Party and continued to run as an independent. And while he counted on the support of Vermont progressives to stay in office and volunteer for his campaigns, his actual campaign infrastructure has always been very separate from the institutions of the fledgling Progressive Party.
He really didn't then build the party or try and build the Green Party, for example.
No, not at all. Bernie's become much more of an environmentalist in recent years. In the old days, I'm told, I wasn't here then, in the 70s, when he was running as a perennial third-party candidate through still existing third-party and or now really fourth-party, because the progressives are established now, called the Liberty Union, which goes back to the early 70s and is still on the ballot as a statewide party here. I'm told that in those days, he was very hostile to the anti-nuclear movement and a lot of other groups that were becoming increasingly focused on environmental issues. But I give him credit for, over the last 10 years or so, having become an increasingly effective environmental advocate. He and Barbara Boxer last year put forward one of the better proposals we've seen in Congress for a progressive carbon tax, where most of the proceeds would go back to individuals, with a percentage being retained, of course, for renewable energy and various demonstration projects and research efforts. He's been, of course, a real champion around economic issues, around international trade issues, but always, again, as we've been saying, playing the inside game with the Democrats in Congress and running as an independent, really not focused in any meaningful way in recent years on helping continue to build the progressive movement here in Vermont.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon, 90.7. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Brian Tokar, who was doing politics for many years in Burlington, Vermont, where Bernie Sanders was first mayor of Burlington and then U.S. congressman from Vermont and now the senator from Vermont. They've had lots of conflicts. Brian has watched Bernie's politics evolve. Let's talk about probably the major permanent factor in Bernie is that he's a top-down social democrat. He's interested in doing good things for people, but he really hasn't built and tried to build progressive movements. Brian, let's conclude with Bernie as a candidate, what you expect to happen, how he's going to push Hillary, and what are the various products that he's looking for in his candidacy.
You know, I have to say I'm very mixed about the whole thing. Having been involved in the very early years of green politics here in the U.S., having seen the evolution of progressive politics in various settings, I'm generally very wary of left involvement in presidential politics. I think it's mostly a distraction. I think it every time there's a significant progressive candidate for president, it takes, and even when there isn't, just dealing with the day-to-day media frenzy of presidential campaigns usually takes a lot of energy and resources away from the continuing development of social movements in this country. On the other hand, there's a real vacuum and there's a real need for a different voice in this election cycle, and I think Bernie is very well positioned to do an exceptionally good job of raising issues that otherwise would be marginalized. I think ultimately, though, Bernie's campaign will probably channel more energy into the Democratic Party and probably eventually the Hillary Clinton campaign, then it will help build the progressive movement in this country. That's a real concern. Bernie loves playing, as I've mentioned, the inside game in the Democratic Party, and my expectation is that as this presidential cycle evolves over the next many, many, many months, that Bernie will continue to be cautious in criticizing Hillary Clinton for some good reasons, for some opportunistic reasons, and will probably not do very much that would help channel energy away from the presidential campaign circus and toward strengthening our various movements.
Vermont has been a very radical state with lots of very interesting political initiatives, including single-payer health care that many people thought was basically one, except for the details. The governor has pulled back and is, in fact, trying to destroy the movement. Also environmental questions with Bill McKibben there and the question of what kind of utility and how we move towards renewables and how fast. Has Bernie weighed in on any of those questions in the state of Vermont as a real actor and supporter of the left?
I mean, he's, as I said, become an increasingly effective environmental voice in national politics, and you know, we give him a lot of credit for that, but he's generally not been that involved in the local issues here, other than healthcare. I mean, he certainly has continued to be a voice for single-payer health care at a time when supporters of single-payer are very much on the defensive in our state capital. As people may know, Governor Shumlin, suddenly after his reelection last November, having campaigned for many years on health care and having really gotten the tacit support of progressives in Vermont because of his advocacy for single-payer, made a speech saying, now's not the time. And we went almost overnight from a feeling that we were on the way toward implementing a public health care system, a universal public health care system, to a situation where we're just back to fighting this all the same old defensive battles around health care that people are dealing with all over the country. Bernie has helped keep the need for universal public health care system in the center of the debate, but his focus is on the national debate much more than on the particulars and all the political craziness and backstepping that's been happening here.
Brian Tokar, it's been so good hearing from you. Thanks a lot for talking to us. Maybe we'll talk again as the Sanders campaign unfolds. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill. Always a pleasure.
Right. So long. Take care.
Bye now.
Mark Twain said, "Those of you who are inclined to worry have the widest selection in history." Why complain? Try to do something about it. You know, it's going on 9 months now since I decided that I was going to declare that I am a candidate for the presidency of the United States. Oh, yes, I'm going to run. We shopped around for a party. Well, I looked at the Republicans, decided talking to a conservative is like talking to your refrigerator. You know, the light goes on, the light goes off. It's not going to do anything that isn't built into it. And I'm not going to talk to a conservative anymore, and I talked to my damn refrigerator. Working for the Democratic Party now, that's kind of like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM. This is listener-supported radio, 90.7. Later in our program, we will hear an article by Jack A. Smith about the disappearance of class terms, followed by a discussion about psychology and climate change. But next on The Old Mole, we have The Left and the Law with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker. Jan?
You're up.
In North Charleston, South Carolina, where Walter Scott was killed by an officer in April, the city this month announced that it would deploy body-mounted cameras for officers on its force. And this policy does indeed have widespread public support. In fact, body cams were a central demand from activists and Michael Brown's family after his death in Ferguson, Missouri. Mike, let's talk about the use of video cameras in the criminal justice system. And we're going to be covering a number of settings and the implications of use of cameras in different settings involving the police or investigators. But let's start with some of that, the history, particularly of citizens' use of cameras in crime situations. What do you see as some of the important lessons from that recent history?
Well, we know that filming something makes a vivid impression that is far more dramatic than anyone describing what they saw. The death of Eric Garner in Staten Island in New York. The film, if you watch it, shows five cops piling onto an unresisting Garner as if they were wrestling a steer at a rodeo. One cop had a chokehold, held it tight, while the others pressed Garner face down on the sidewalk. He said, "I can't breathe," and repeated it many times before he died while the police were fumbling with handcuffs. It was that spectacle, a lot more than the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, that led to demonstrations which continue and movements forming all in American cities to protest against mistreatment and killing of citizens with impunity. And then the shooting of Walter Scott in South Carolina showed a remarkable aftermath. He shot somebody and killed him while Scott was running away. But then the cop walks over and casually drops down a taser next to him and then writes the kind of conventional report that we've seen over and over where the policeman says, I was afraid for my life. And everybody has reflexively accepted that rationale, particularly DAs, prosecuting agencies, grand juries. But we can never again hear that phrase, I was afraid for my life, in the same light after having seen what happened with the shooting death of Walter Scott.
Well, there are many forensic psychologists who deal with eyewitness testimony who've actually, like Elizabeth Loftus, who's built a whole career around the problems of eyewitness testimony that also can be quite convincing to juries. Say, I saw that man. She's shown, and others through many experiments, that people can be very confident of what they see and be absolutely wrong. Confidence has no relationship to the accuracy of eyewitness reports. And some of that discussion followed the Rodney King case, and maybe we could talk a little bit about that, because that often is the one that comes to mind, where it was part of a broader became part of a broader anti-police movement, and was the broader scene or context was the history of racism with the LAPD police department. And Loftus, in her analysis of the use of the filming of the Rodney King beating by the police, suggests some reasons why that did not contribute to a conviction of the officers. Just seeing that, even though it was riveting and had a very powerful political impact, what's your reading of that case, and why the video recording of the beating, which was so palpably brutal, did not convince a jury?
Because the jury was chosen from peers of the police officers. The trial took place in Simi Valley, which is a white suburb, over 90% white, where many of the officers who work in L.A. actually live. That's the determinative thing. But the defense in the criminal trial against Rodney King was very clever. They played the tape over and over and over. They blew it up and they played it silently until people were like numbed by all the repetition. It finally became like wallpaper in the criminal trial.
But the context, Loftus also emphasizes context, and that the portion people saw on the news did not include many of the contextual factors that influence the police, the franticness, the chaos of the situation, the long chase scene, that he had resisted arrest, and a lot of the prior context that could very well have made the police frightened and, you know, work to the benefit of their defense.
Well, had they put on this very same trial in Los Angeles, the vivid video, 81 seconds, would have carried the day, and it did carry the day. Let's remember, Rodney King won $4 million with that same tape, and the defense using those same contextual efforts to weaken the power of that video in Los Angeles, which is where there he won his civil rights case. So it's true, there are always ways to undercut, to file off the sharp edges, and clever defense lawyers get paid well to do just that. But the fact is, we would not be talking about that case at all had there not been a video. Now, that was 1992. There were video cameras around, but today everybody has a video camera. Cell phones enable them to watch us. They always know where we are, but it enables us to film them. There's always in everyone's pocket, and I mean everyone, there's 60 million iPhones sold in 3 months.
And so in a way, it's a response to the surveillance society, because for a long time, left cultural theorists talked about that panopticon effect, you know, cameras everywhere. You know, in any given day, there's a camera shooting some kind of footage for much of your day in public life, and that this does lead to a certain compliance with the law. But is that a good thing? You were saying that...
Well, in this context, it is, because body cams on police officers have always led to fewer complaints against the cops. Once the cops have a body camera on, the fact is that other people, as well as the cop himself or herself, behave differently. They're on stage. It's not the same.
Well, let's return to that issue of the point of view of the camera, because you have the citizens' use of cameras where you're kind of taking these instruments of surveillance into our own hands and turning the camera on to speaking back to power, in a sense, looking back at power, versus the point of view of the officers and the disciplining effect of that. But there is quite an interesting line of research on video, the use of video cameras in confessions and interrogations, that tells us perhaps a more complicated story about the use of cameras. I've been very interested as a filmmaker in that, knowing how, where you direct the camera, where you put the camera, whether it's close up, far off, whose point of view you're using, whether you're looking up or down, can have enormous emotional impact on the experience of the image. What about the use of cameras in confessions and interrogations? What's your take on that literature and the findings there?
Well, it's very clear that if the only person being filmed is a suspect who's being interrogated, any confession that ensues is more likely to be found voluntary than if the camera shows all parties equally. That's why the power of these Walter Scott, Rodney King, Eric Kremers, it shows everybody. It shows not only the suspect, but also what the officers are doing. Confessions are, if a confession is filmed and the camera is constantly on a nervous and sweating suspect, he's not going to get, or she's not going to get, as favorable a consideration on any issue, say, challenging the voluntariness of a confession.
But, I think it's not always clear to people why that, through what mental processes that effect is achieved. Because it, on one level, seems counterintuitive, that you think you're seeing the suspect's perspective because you're focusing on the suspect, but it's actually the opposite. If you had the camera on the suspect looking at the interrogator, you'd have a different effect. Why do you think that effect is so powerful? It's shown, it's quite a robust finding, that the sympathies are with the interrogator if the camera's on the suspect.
Because we're not seeing anything that the interrogator is doing. So therefore, the interrogator is like God. We can't see God, but the kind of basic scuffling humanity of every interrogator is entirely omitted. And it is a powerful effect. But let's not get too smart about this. I mean, we know the point of view is important. As a filmmaker, if you're aiming your camera up at somebody, you're going to get a different effect than if you're aiming it down at somebody. But the fact is that these recordings, and particularly citizen recordings, include the entire event. They may not include all the context. Well, that would require all of life to be filmed. You're never going to get the entire context. But the fact is, you can record vivid, comprehensive, and complete moments that are definitive, that are the killing of Walter Scott, the casual way the cop walks over there and drops down and goes back, no hurry here because he's dead. The way they arrange their aftermath of the shooting is so institutionalized. You think, do they practice this? I mean, it has a casual air about it where you think, well, yes, they do. There's a way in which, what do you do if somebody is dead or if they're wounded, or how do you find out and how do you write it up? These kind of things, there's lore, that's passed down, and it happens enough. It happens everywhere. It happens all the time. And we didn't really know that in our bones, even though we suspected it. We're just dubious about police encounters. But now we know that this is something that is done. And the statement later that I was afraid for my life was utter nonsense, self-serving, and corrupt and deserving of a murder charge.
What about the more mundane aspects of harassment and the kind of subtle humiliations of daily life? I mean, a lot of my own interest has kind of followed the less dramatic ways in which people are undermined and humiliated, and I think some of these dramatic cases are very riveting and bringing into bold relief the level of violence carried out by the state. But I do wonder, and I think the jury's still out on the use of cameras in more kind of subtle, mundane forms of humiliation where, you know, it's not so clear what's going on and there may be ambiguities that are not so effectively captured by the camera itself.
Cameras are not a universal panacea. They're not going to solve all the problems of the power relationships. But I think they do have inhibiting effects on precisely those low-level encounters, and for fear that by the officer that this may like blow up into something that I don't want. And so, cameras do have, I think, an ameliorative effect at a lot of levels, small everyday encounters as well as really big ones. And it's not certainly going to solve everything about our relationships with the police.
And indeed, in building a story like Fruitvale Station was a wonderful documentary film, very creatively realized and well produced, about the police killing a young man on the BART in Oakland. And, you know, this story unfolds around how really wonderful and virtuous this guy was, just turning his life around, all of which may have been true. But then there's always this question of how the story unfolds around the images. And I think there has been a reliance in the left on kind of an excess of virtue set against the brutal fist of the state. And I think it is important to deal with these more subtle encounters of power in daily life, and that everyday people who are not so virtuous also are harmed in more subtle ways.
Yeah, if you're an everyday thug who commits a misdemeanor, you do not deserve capital punishment. You don't get to be killed because you're not a perfect and virtuous person.
Yeah. Well, there's probably more to return to on that front. Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the use of video cameras in the criminal justice system.
Ah, yes, the world, planet Earth, third from the sun of a gun. 360 degrees, and as new worlds emerge, stay alert, stay aware, watch the eagle, watch the bear. Earthquaking, foundation shaking, bias breaking, new day making change. Accumulating, liberating, educating, stimulating change. Tomorrow was born yesterday. From inside the rib or the people cage, the era of our first blood stage.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Still to come on the Old Mole, a discussion about what psychoanalytic psychology can tell us about public responses to climate change and environmental activism. But next we have well-read Tom Becker here with an article on class terms and warrior capitalism. Tom?
Good morning. The history of all hitherto existing society, Marx wrote, is the history of class struggles. But Marx further contended that unless the working class became a class not only in itself, that is merely existing, but evolve into a class for itself, that is, an organized body in active pursuit of its own interests, it could never fulfill the mission of bringing about the socialist vision Marx prophesied. To forestall such a possibility, the myth was created that by those in power that we are a classless society. In fact, discussion of class has become almost totally absent from political debates. My reading today is entitled Warrior Capitalism, Middle Class, What Middle Class? By Jack A. Smith. A complex class system exists in the United States, Smith begins, but the mass media and political rhetoric generally reduces it to three components, the middle class and two economic generalizations, rich and poor. Indeed, the term class itself, as a means of defining the economic and social status of population, has been fading away. Virtually the only class ever mentioned these days is the middle class, and now that seems on its way out, because it may remind people that this once sacrosanct vehicle for attaining the American dream seems to be falling apart and taking the dream down with it. Whatever happened to the term upper class? It's hardly used at all these days, gone as well as general usage of lower class, lower middle class, and upper middle class, all popular designations in the past, but rare now. They may not have been scientific, but people knew what they meant. Remember when there was a working class in our country? The frequent reference to this class a few decades ago has nearly vanished today. Its members became sold on the idea that benefits and security awaited their families in the middle class. The poor and very low-wage workers were pushed into their own weak category, belonging neither to the working class nor middle class. One reason for this entire transformation was to suppress the memory and continuing existence of a more militant era in U.S. history, when the working class and the union movement was strong and tough. Nearly all unions now avoid mention of the working class, substituting working families or employees. But mostly the unions now identify their members as part of the all-embracing and utterly misleading ticket to paradise known as membership in the middle class. The U.S. government and the corporate elite work together to transform a bothersome working class into a relatively placid middle class desiring to attain its new status. It was a cunning way to disarm the working class and the union movement as well. In the U.S. today, over 60% of the workforce holds the same working class jobs, but in more exalted middle class, but in the more exalted middle class, they have little say in production or anything else. The wages and benefits of virtually all working class jobs have been stagnant for many years. Layoffs are frequent, joblessness is high, and unions much weaker. Virtually obliterated in the term ruling class to describe the relatively small group of billionaire and upper millionaire capitalist plutocrats, corporate leaders, bank presidents, financiers, and their highly paid henchmen who possess the power to decisively influence, if not totally control the political system, the financial system, and the functioning of big business in our society. Many of the missing class categories are subsumed into the middle class, supposedly consisting of individuals or families earning between $35,000 and $100,000 a year. In reality, government and business propaganda long suggested that the middle class is one big happy family earning between $20,000 and $200,000 annually. After that, the sky was the limit for anyone who was willing to work hard. This all seemed like a good deal for those who hadn't already been tossed overboard, until it was finally perceived by millions of working people during the bitter experience of the Great Recession beginning in September 2008, that the middle class seemed to be in the process of decomposition. Government safety nets primarily served the rich, big banks, and Wall Street. Suddenly things got clearer for many workers. Washington's capitalist economics and trade deals were leading to offshoring jobs to low-wage countries, to weak unions, wage stagnation, increasing economic inequality, and expanding hard times for multitudes of people. This and other realities have aroused the consciousness of millions of people to the extent that they have come to doubt or simply disbelieve certain of the revered myths about America that they were taught throughout their lives. Perhaps the most important in this regard is that membership in the middle class is a one-way ticket to economic security for themselves and their families. Now, for the first time since the end of World War II, the corporate class has decided to downplay the importance of the middle class in the next elections, according to the New York Times, and in an article entitled "Middle Class is Disappearing, at least from the vocabulary of the possible 2016 contenders." It reads in part, Hillary Clinton claims them everyday Americans. Scott Walker prefers hardworking taxpayers. Rand Paul says he speaks for people who work, for the people who own businesses. Bernie Sanders talked about ordinary Americans. The once ubiquitous term middle class has gone conspicuously missing from the 2016 campaign trail as candidates and their strategists grasp for new terms for an unsettled economic era. The phrase, long synonymous with the American dream, now evokes anxiety, an uncertain future, and a lifestyle that is increasingly out of reach. The move away from middle class is a rhetorical result of a critical shift. The middle class has, for millions of families, become a precarious place to be. The popularization of the idea that we are the 99% in opposition to the 1% who rule America was the best thing Occupy Wall Street did in its relatively brief existence. It was an eye-opener for so many people. It gave a concrete form to an abstract idea. So that's who's doing this to us. not to follow up in a big way on the deepened consciousness of the American people about unequal distribution of wealth, Washington's failures to protect democracy, the degeneration of the electoral process, the increasing exploitation of workers, the decline of the fundamental class, and the extraordinary power of the 1% ruling class that controls the U.S. on behalf of the neoliberal form of warrior capitalism would be short-sighted in the extreme for progressive and left movements. That was an article by Jack A. Smith entitled Warfare Capitalism, Middle Class, What Middle Class? It can be found in the Counterpunch webpage. Smith is the editor of Activist Newsletter.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We conclude today's show with Politics and Psychology. That is Jan Hocken and Todd Sloan here with me at KBOO this morning. Hello, you guys. They're going to talk about psychoanalytic psychology. Jan, you say this all the time as if it's nothing.
Is that some kind of Freudian inhibition, not being able to pronounce the word.
I think so. I'm going to just turn it over to you guys. Okay. So welcome. Thanks.
Well, Todd and I were recently reading and discussing a book titled Engaging with Climate Change, Disciplinary and Interdisciplinary Perspectives, edited by Sally Weintraub. And the book does indeed engage the issue of climate change, going beyond kind of the everyday uses of psychology that would include denial that I think people are familiar with, thinking about climate change deniers and apathy, indifference, helplessness, and trying to bring into the dialogue more complex and dynamic mental processes involved in dealing with this which I think all would agree a quite frightening specter of a very bad future. Todd, what was your take on some of the insights in this book and how they might inform our thinking about climate change?
Well, this is another case where we have to move very slowly and look at all of the complex ways that people respond to an event that itself is very complex, and situations. Climate change itself is a compounded occurrence from all sorts of forces, economic, natural, etc. So the psychological level is equally complex, and the book does a good job of bringing out many of the different processes that you might not consider. I mean, just you can imagine, for example, that many people just don't know enough about climate change to worry about it. So you can't say that they're ignoring it or denying it. There's some who know a lot about it and are upset about it, and then probably do some kind of suppressing or cognitive moves to not pay attention to it too much, perhaps because they don't know what they can do about it or things like that. One of the chapters I find interesting here is the one by our colleague Renee Lertzman, who has also recently is publishing a book called Environmental Melancholia, where she challenges the idea that people must be apathetic about climate change and other environmental destruction because they aren't doing something about it. Instead, she shows through her interviews with people about their lives, depth interviews, that they actually do care. Many actually do care deeply and have a strong connection to the environment, and but just don't decide that joining an environmental action group is the way to respond to that. So they're dealing with a complex array of, depending on the individual, wide variety of mourning or yearning or splitting kinds of moves, where they have contradictory feelings about the phenomena.
And acknowledging that people are conflicted and can hold in mind both hope and despair.
Right. So apathy, she calls it the myth of apathy. So mm-hmm. I think that's useful to not just look at the surface of what's going on. And in psychoanalysis in general is always showing what you don't see, what you don't hear. So
yeah, it's quite an interesting line of social psychological research on the bystander intervention effect that really it kind of drew me into psychology as a young woman. Mm-hmm. I was very disturbed by this study done, became famous as the Kitty Genovese study, mm-hmm. of people who watched a woman being killed by a knife from an apartment in New York, and no one called the police or did anything about it. And of course, now we have a more complex understanding of policing and witnessing, mm-hmm. and that there are complicated dynamics going on. But the first interpretation of those findings was that people would just assume somebody else would do something.
Right, it's called diffusion of responsibility. They assume that somebody is going to hear this and, I can't figure out what I would do, or I might get hurt if I intervene or something myself. Right.
Yeah.
So they let someone else do it. And in the case of climate change, there's that same thing. Many people feel like, well, it's the government or business that should do something about it. Maybe I could ride my bike more or something, but it's hard to figure out what of the many possible tactics and strategies would actually make a difference big enough to make a difference given the scale of what's happening.
And then the second wave of findings did focus on that very point, that people are more apt to intervene if they feel they have something to do or contribute that's helpful. And mm-hmm. so it brought in this whole notion of efficacy, not just that people didn't care, but right. whether people feel that they have something to do. And of course, activists have, that's kind of activism 101, get mm-hmm. people involved.
Another aspect of that is that things that are very far away or very abstract are hard to connect to. Like if you see someone being hurt right next to you, you're more likely to try and help. But even the images of the polar bears on icebergs are things that are far from most people in their everyday life, and they may have some pang of empathy, but then still it's something. And also things that might be happening 30, 40 years from now to future generations are harder to connect to than something that's affecting people right now in a very direct and obvious way.
Yeah, and not only psychoanalytic psychologists, but in general, psychology has documented a tendency for us not only to respond to immediate acute threats, but more we're organized toward modes of storytelling where we try to identify a discrete villain that can be vanquished, and that and generally stories and narratives related to war involve that kind of narrative. You're fighting an enemy, that enemy becomes embodied in propaganda in certain ways, and then there is the anticipated victory. And of course, that's been a problem for these endless wars we're in now. Mm-hmm. A big problem for the hawks, that there's no end to this war, and so there's always this problem of having to come up with new enemies to rally people.
Right. So in the case of climate change, it's hard to identify who the big enemy is, and certainly you can see maybe some people try to you know, paint the people in the boardrooms making investment decisions into exploring for future oil as the bad guys. But then each of us who drives a car, uses petroleum products in, you know, in our homes, is are you can immediately sort of undermine your attack on those people by the fact that you are also benefiting or using the, these products that and would have a hard time without. Without them in the future, so.
Well, maybe it might be good to talk a bit about the college divestment movement, and also how how to take into account that we are implicated and dependent on a system that is in and of itself destructive, and we can't untangle ourselves from that system and stand from kind of a virtuous observer position. Mm-hmm. But there's also a huge difference between you driving your car here to the studio this morning and the people who are cashing in on these oil reserves. And I think people get kind of tripped up in kind of the imperfections of people trying to make a difference in the world. Right. And that as though that's hypocrisy on the level of these of Shell Oil board, you know.
So that's why the fossil fuel divestment campaigns are really important, I think, because people, especially college students and faculty who have some extra time to be thinking about the condition of the world and studying science and so forth, have processed the information that we really can't exploit the reserves that we have without really trashing the planet. So they're organizing to make sure that their own education at least is not financed by the money from fossil fuel exploitation. So they're trying to get colleges, college boards in particular, and presidents to get the funds in the endowments out of fossil fuels, especially the most noxious ones like tar sands and shale and so forth. So there are lots of colleges across the country who've where the campaigns are strong. Some have already succeeded. Some big places, Stanford already got out of coal, and University of Washington as well, recently, just last week. Places like Swarthmore, the board has decided not to divest, so the students will probably be, when they come back in the fall, probably be stepping up their campaigns. They had sit-ins in the administration building and so forth. So there's lots of exciting things happening, a lot of momentum.
What are some of the activists where you teach at Lewis and Clark here locally? What are some of the challenges of student activists and faculty and staff around that issue there?
There, it seems to be hard to get going on a campaign when there's all sorts of different causes that people could get involved in, and this one somehow, once you sign your name to a signature, unless you're willing to go block operations or something, that what's the next step? You can inform people for a long time. One thing that happens generally across the country, and not only at Lewis and Clark, is that we get the initial responses are, well, you know, we can't do this. The finances of the college or the university would be screwed up if we had to pull. We can't even figure out where all the investments are. They're in fossil fuels. Funds are commingled and are, you know, spread out across mutual funds and different kinds of donations from alumni and so forth. So then it's not up to the students to figure out where all that money is, right? So it's up to the board and financial advisors of the colleges to do that homework.
I wonder if that's also a place for alliances among with labor activists who've also confronted this same argument. You know, and I know even at Portland State, when faculty organize around a contract, the university said, we cannot afford it. We just don't have funds. And it's always a response. And then you look around and lo and behold, there are funds. It depends, and you can untangle these effects. But right. It also takes you into the heart of certain darkness of finance, and that right. can be a very instructive too.
So at the first level, it's really a moral and symbolic task to get that across, so people pay attention to the details you're mentioning.
So, we'll have to return. We're going to do this for a few months, right? And talk about it'll still be an issue by the end of the summer, I think. Psychology and climate change. This is Jan Hocken and Todd Sloan talking today about the contributions of psychoanalysis to the issue.
Thanks, you guys. Yes, this has been the Old Mole Variety Hour. It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Thanks to our Old Mole contributors and guests, my guests here with me, Jan Hocken and Todd Sloan, Bill Resnick, Brian Tokar, Mike Snedeker, Tom Becker, and our engineer, Patsy Kohlberg. Thanks, everyone. Let me tell you what's coming up on KBOO later this morning. Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we'll have a public affairs special about Measure 289. That's a local food system ordinance in Benton County. At 10:15, it's Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein and a look at the eruption of Mount St. Helens and its aftermath 35 years on. Guest is Professor Scott Burns in geology at Portland State University. 11 o'clock, Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. A discussion of the book, The Anti-Cancer Diet, Reduce Cancer Risk through the Foods You Eat. That's author Dr. David Kayat. And at 11:30 on the Monday Morning Radio Zine, host Paul Rowland interviews David Gessner, author of the new book, All the Wild That Remains, Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner, and the American West. That's all we have for this morning. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next Monday.
And you do have it tuned to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. As you just heard, coming up next, Sam Bowman speaks with Brett Diamond of the Benton Food Freedom Campaign for Measure 2-89, the local food system ordinance that creates rights relating to agriculture and prohibits genetically engineered organisms. It looks like Sam, the boo player is gone, so go for it. You're on.
All right. Good morning. Thank you for listening to KBOO Community Radio. The time is now 10 o'clock. My name is Sam Bowman. Air Cascadia is on a break this morning, but we're going to take a look instead at a measure on tomorrow's ballot in Benton County. Benton County is in the southern Willamette Valley. It's home to Corvallis, Oregon State University, and a significant agricultural economic base. Measure 289 seeks to make Benton the second county in Oregon to ban genetically modified organisms.